This is a CNA podcast.
This is the Heart of the Matter. I'm Jamie Ho. I'm talking about drugs this week, and more specifically, new psychoactive substances, or NPSs. Well, during the Committee of Supply debates in Parliament this March, the Ministry of Home Affairs highlighted a threat they said was creeping up in Singapore, the rise of rogue chemists producing these NPSs, which ultimately end up on our streets. What challenges does this place for authorities? How have designer drugs, together with changing attitudes, changed the drug situation in Singapore? Well, with me to discuss these questions are Amrin Amin, Senior Parliamentary Secretary of the Ministry of Home Affairs, and Razwana Begum, Head of the Public Safety and Security Program at the Singapore University of Social Sciences. Amrin and Razwana, so thank you very much for joining me today. I'm going to pose the first question to Amrin. Question for the man on the street. Just explain to us what NPSs actually are. What are these new psychoactive substances? How are they different from what people may be used to? Because when you talk about drugs, people have a certain conception of drugs. Heroin, cocaine, marijuana, that kind of thing. So what's an NPS? And what has made the ministry focus on it as an issue? Because to be frank, for most people, it'd be sort of transparent. They wouldn't know it's a problem. So maybe you start off by explaining to us.
Okay, maybe I start with what's the same. And what's the same is that these are very dangerous substances. It is called new psychoactive substances. They mimic the psychoactive effects of traditional drugs. But they come in different forms and sometimes they have different names that downplay the seriousness of the damage and the harm it caused to people. So that's the thing about this NPS, that it works in insidious ways, you know. Mm-hmm. It makes you let your gut down, and then there's also misinformation that says that, you know, these things are not that bad. And so they get marketed in all kinds of names, you know.
But give me an example.
Examples would be magic mushroom, mm-hmm. right? There are many, many examples, but that's just what's on the market. So that is something that we have to guard against, because what they do is that they change the chemical structure. Mm-hmm. These are synthetic drugs. Mm. They manufacture them in labs and then they change the chemical structure. But the chemical structure is somewhat similar to traditional drugs, but they add certain ingredients. And that is partly the source of danger as well, because we do not know what is the true ingredients of this.
And what impacts
exact
they may
ingredient,
have,
exactly, and what it causes, and if you take it, how does it interact with your body, especially if you have a pre-existing condition. So I think these are things that we have to be watchful for, and that's what is different. In the traditional sense, the chemical compound of the drugs are somewhat there. You know, it's a stable compound. But with these new psychoactive substances, the chemical structure changes, and it evolves, and as a result, it also presents challenges for law enforcement, because we base our laws on the we pin it down based on specific set of procedures in terms of testing. We have proper testing mechanisms, so we want to make sure that we catch people that take harmful things, and we want to prove what is the harm caused by a particular chemical compound. But if the chemical compound keeps changing, that presents challenges in terms of our law and order situation. And that is what we are trying to address with the new legislation. So you'll see the risks. The known risks, as I mentioned just now, are, you know, renal failure, you know, heart diseases, and many others. But the situation in Singapore is actually under control.
Okay.
But it is something that we are worried about, because we are seeing a growing prevalence, and it is currently the third most commonly used drug in Singapore and the second most common among new abusers. So this stark increase is something that we cannot ignore, because you look at the numbers, you know, if we don't do something now, it may get out of hand in the future.
Give me a sense also of the sources and the supply for these substances, because again, for the average person who doesn't really have an idea of the drug scene, again, you have an idea of where marijuana would come from. You have an idea of who produces heroin and cocaine. But clearly, from the way you have described this, this is something which can be produced by anyone, a chemist with a chemistry degree sitting in at home, right? Is that also a concern that you don't know where it's coming from?
I think we have a sense on where this MPS are being produced. But of course, it's not good for me to specifically mention where.
Okay.
We have a sense.
Yeah.
But I think the key point is that it is actually everywhere.
Mm.
You know, it is something that we are concerned about because Singaporeans travel all over these days. You know, if we do not educate them, if we do not inform them of the risks, if we do not let them know that they might still get caught if they are tested at the borders, we will be in for a hard time if relaxed attitude of drugs take root.
Mm.
In particular, NPS, because they see it as new and then they think that, you know, maybe new equals less harmful. So I think these are the kind of attitudes that we need to keep in check.
Well, maybe I'll turn the question now to Razwana based upon something that Amrin said just now, in that a big percentage of new abusers somehow have turned to this as their first point of abuse, right? Mm. And that's, I don't know whether this suggests a certain demographic of people who do use NPSs. Have you got a sense of where they come from and what kind of demographic is involved?
I mean, I'm basing my data on what CNB has released last year. A lot of our young users below the age of 29, they are taking, for some users, they're taking NPS. And we have, I mean, strangely, there's also an increase between the age of 50 to 59, double the amount of people who are taking NPS as well. Or first-time drug users, we may not know whether is it really NPS or other forms of drugs. But we do know that NPS is easily accessible and it's easy for us to, you know, get it, you know, we can buy it on the net. There's a possibility there. Like what, you know, Amrin has highlighted, if you travel within the region itself, you know, has got a high level of production of meth, you know, and it's easy. And you have all these peer review discussion boards, people coming up with recipes online, young people picking it up, you know, and they're very savvy. They know how to not get detected. I think that's the real big challenge when it comes to law enforcement. A lot of countries have called it the legal highs. Because what they do is they manipulate the components, right? And they make it look like a...
Something else.
Something else. Not meant for humans. They call it like plant food, you know, bath salt. You know, these are the terms that they use. And it becomes so common that, you know, it's so easy. And people, young people who travel, maybe not even young, you know, now we look at the other generation, you know, the demographics really changing. And when they travel, they look at it as, I'm trying it one off, you know, perhaps I'm in another country and gives me this high, why not, you know. And they look at it as, maybe it's legal, maybe it's illegal, but I don't really know. I don't really know the impact. Very little information that we have on the impact.
So, Amrin, so the is there also a problem, therefore, as you say, we don't know actually what the impacts of these things, these new drugs are, how addictive they may be. For example, if I can imagine if you're a young person and you're traveling or you're in a club and someone offers it to you, you may imagine that it's not as addictive. Do you see that as a problem as well because people don't know? And secondly, is there any evidence of it being sort of like a gateway type of drug where, yes, you try it for the first time, but does that then lead you to other things down the road?
First, there is a perception problem, and that is clear. They let their guard down, is what Razwana said just now, about certain innocent-sounding names. Yeah, and that is the problem. Let's get to the facts. There are known risks, and the known risks based on the identifiable NPS, or new psychoactive substances, are quite clear. Very, very clear, in fact. As I mentioned just now, renal failure among many, you know, problems with, you know, all your bodily functions, your different bodily functions. I think that's known. But what's not known would be far worse. So it is not just a question of a gateway drug. Of course, that is a concern in itself.
Okay.
But the damage itself is severe. It's serious. The gateway drug is another thing. Of course, the impact for these drugs usually is not immediate, in terms of you don't just pop a pill and suddenly you get renal failure. No, not in most cases. Of course, there are cases of people getting overdosed, you know. We have read reports in many places. Example would be you just Google on YouTube. You see people, the effects of bath salts, people jumping out of buildings.
Bath salts in inverted commas, bath salts.
Correct. You know, people jumping out of buildings, people going out, you know, stripping naked in highways and running and feeling the sense of, you know, total lack of control, you know, and total lack of restraint. I think these are some very clear examples. So I think the points that you mentioned are totally right. The danger to the body, to our mental faculties is one very, very serious risk. Another is the gateway drug, because that becomes a sense of initiation. And there are quite a number of people who are poly drug users. They take these drugs, they combine with other drugs, and that is actually a recipe for overdose. Because you don't really actually know what is in the substance. On your NPS substance, already you do not know how high the dosage is. You do not know where the products are from. It's not as if they have a nutritional information labels that says where, right? So I think these are all very real risks. And this is something that we are looking to do to protect our people.
Razwana, give me a sense as well, as you've studied this a little bit. What is the... the word I use is sociological. How do you explain young people, or even older ones, as you as you mentioned just now, being a little bit more liberal and open, or not too concerned about side effects and things like that when they approach these drugs? Is it because social media has changed the way people approach it? Because again, socially, people have already, through their youth, for example, been told about the dangers of traditional drugs.
Yes.
But I suppose much less has been said about these newer psychoactive substances. And has that led to a letting down of guards by everyone? The younger users, their parents, and then the older people as well.
I would think if you were to look at the desire for taking such drugs, right? There are many reasons. Some take it out of curiosity. Some take it as a party drug. They just want to do it, you know, one time and, you know, follow their friends and have a good time, you know, for that night. But there are also others who take it as a form of medication. They think that that would help them, you know, get rid of their paranoia, their anxiety. There are others, repeated drug users, who have highlighted that they need this to be able to work. You know, they work long hours and they kind of need this drug, this stimulant to keep them alert. There are many different reasons for this, you see. Of course, a lot of it got to do with, I want to just have a good time and this helps me for a moment. It's a bit like, perhaps it's a bit like consuming alcohol. You know, you just want to go to a party, you know, have a good time, and you go back and the next day you're fine. Or that's what they think, without knowing the ingredients that goes into this can be very dangerous.
I mean, so this is something which the government has also raised on several occasions in terms of changing attitudes. You would describe it as more liberal attitudes towards drugs, medicinal drugs, situations changing around the world. Outline again, what really is the challenge that you see here? Because underlying all this is that people really seem to be, it's okay to have a legal high, right? When did you see this actually happening? Has it sort of taken off on a quite a steep curve and you guys are trying to nip it in the bud?
We did a survey and the survey showed that 1 in 5 held the view that cannabis abuse should be legal in Singapore. This also reflects, I suppose, the data of the number of new abusers that were young. 3 in 5 new drug abusers treated or caught last year were below 30. So this is a source of concern. And I think the attitude wasn't so sudden. It's not like today you wake up and tomorrow suddenly there's, you know, change attitude. I think it has got to do with the slow drip of lies and half-truths that have been circulated online, propagated by celebrities, ill-informed celebrities, and irresponsible media reporting about a cavalier attitude on drugs. I think that's it. It is about this irresponsible outlets that think that, you know, a little bit of drugs don't do you much harm. And this stems from a society, or in their society, where they have failed to keep the drug laws, you know, adequately enforce. They have problems in their respective countries. Mm. And as a result, they think that the less or the best evil is actually to liberalize certain drugs so that they can control, in the hope that, you know, they can use some of the legal sale to support their health. But that is, of course, very wrong, because some countries have done that, and we've seen the sorry state they're in right now. Mm. We've looked at the homelessness. We've looked at, you know, the number of people that are being in their emergency rooms. And of course, you know, the legal market does not supplant the black market. It is still thriving in these countries that have legalized drugs. So that's the reality that our people need to see, that we are not preaching, you know, overuse lines, or we are not being... It is not a question of being cool or liberal versus traditional. Mm. You know, it's actually a question of what is right. And what is right right now is that a zero tolerance policy on drugs, where we keep our people away. And actually, that is the meaning of freedom. That is the meaning of being cool, to be not shackled by addiction. Mm. I think that is what we are trying to get to our people, and that is what they must realize. The first part is about ideas, misinformation, and the second part is what Razwana spoke about supply. Mm. Right? It is quite easy to go online. She spoke about recipes that you can Google. I'm not talking about tasty.com, but certain recipes that you know are quite harmful. And that is why we have made changes to the Misuse of Drugs Act, where people who, you know, play a role in terms of promoting or propagating drug use will get caught under the Misuse of Drugs Act. And we have also taken action. So for people who think that you can go online and buy things and think that it's anonymous, please think very, very carefully. Because we have caught people who have done these things, and we would not go easy on them. And I think, please be warned.
Yeah, if I could go back to specifically the issue of the NPSs, because it would going back to the first comments that you were making, it's sort of like a cat and mouse game, uphill battle. We are trying to keep up with people who sit in their labs and tweak, as Razwana was saying, tweak their formula and the formulations so that you slip under the radar of enforcement. Are there examples of other countries out there, other jurisdictions who seem to also be aware of that? Are you sort of looking to examples overseas, certain countries which have done quite well or move their laws in a way to keep up with this cat and mouse game?
Certainly, we are looking at various countries that have got legislation and different ways of doing it. I think this is a global issue, a very challenging issue. We have done quite well compared to most of these countries. Our numbers are pretty much kept in check, but Singapore being Singapore, we learn from the very best from, you know, all the different places, and we will incorporate. And that is what we are doing when we are studying this legislation. Mm. And this is something that we pay close attention to.
So what kind of approach is it? Is it because I would imagine now you have a schedule sort of things which are illegal substances, right? And the way that it works, people look at that list as a positive list. So whatever's not on that list is okay. How are you going to change? I mean, MHA has spoken about reviewing the legislation. So is it sort of like boiling it down to what are the real substances which need to be dealt with? Or are you talking about the effects of it that you're going to have to address as indicators that that substance is not kosher?
I don't want to preempt the review. But what I will say is, what is the situation currently? Today, we do a generic group listing. That means based on the core molecular structure of the NPS. So we have a legislation that looks at the core molecular structure, and then we schedule this drugs in the as a class A controlled drugs, or in the first schedule of the NDA. So that's how we have done it. And of course, we also have we amended the laws back in 2013 to allow for a temporary listing of drugs in the fifth schedule. So this gives the CNB powers to seize such NPS in enforcement operations. These are some of the amendments that we have taken. We will see what else we can do to strengthen. One of it is, as you mentioned, perhaps to look at the effects, is what some countries have done. But we have to strike a balance, because some drugs are being used for legitimate purposes, for prescription purposes, for instance, right? So we have to be very careful that we do not have such a broad sweep such that, you know, it affects the pharmaceutical industry, it affects the medical industry, it affects people from wanting to get the treatment.
I mean, it sounds like when I was young and glue sniffing used to be an issue when, you know, 20, 30 years ago, and bicycle glue used to be an issue, right? And people used to go around bicycle shops looking for it.
Right.
And I don't know how, I mean, I can't remember how the government dealt with it at that time, but it was dealt with quite specifically. But I can imagine now you don't want to start banning bicycle glue all over again. But I suppose it's a little bit like that. But I was wondering if I could get back to you as well, because I was trying to get Amrin to talk about positive examples in countries which have dealt with this. But if you look around the region, if you look around internationally, are you also concerned from people that you may have spoken to in terms of how they got their first high? Is it also from when they travel, where do they go to? And sort of attitudes internationally, both within people and within governments. Is that something you're concerned with?
I would think that, I mean, what we are doing in Singapore with the zero tolerance approach is very good, because it's working, and we are trying to, you know, address a lot of other social issues that comes from this. But at the same time, I feel that, of course, you know, we can definitely be ahead in terms of predicting what kind of substance that we should be mindful about. We can come up with a robust way of testing. A couple of years ago, we started testing hair, you know, instead of just doing urine tests and all that. We still have that, you know, glue sniffing situation, but it's not so bad. It's manageable. But at the same time, I feel that we also need to address the demand. Why is there a desire for this group of individuals who are taking it? So apart from the young people who are, you know, probably being desensitized with what's happening in the media, like what Amrin was saying in terms of, you know, superstars, you know, and people who are sharing, you know, openly about the benefits, so-called benefits of such abuse. The thing is that we know for sure, clearly, there are negative effects. So in their mind, they think there's some positive implications to taking drugs, you know. I'm just doing it one time. I'm not an addict. Don't address me as an addict. They look at it as I'm a user, different from abuser, right? So when they look at it from this perspective, then we need to give them evidence to show that even if you are a user, if you don't know what you're taking, and if you have pre-existing condition, you could just die. That's possible. We have seen that even in Singapore, our ER, sometimes we do have cases like this. Apart from that, I think the desire is also in the context of how do you manage, you know, things like stress. People take it because, you know, they feel that they can't cope with their studies. Even university students, poly students are doing it. So those are like the psychosocial intervention that we need to put in. So we have very good regulatory system, which I'm very proud, you know, that we have this. And of course, we don't want to go in the basis of what has happened in the UK. Like one example would be the, you know, the zombie epidemic. They had that in Manchester. We have another study that was done by Newcastle Youth Offending Team. In the UK as well, and they were looking at how can we co-manage this situation with the young people. So that was interesting as well, because they got the young people on board to hear their perspective, why they're taking drugs. You know, let's address the root cause of it, the desire for it, you know, and if you can replace that desire with something positive, you know, so that would be the best way. So, you know, just three ways from that particular study. Regulatory is there. Definitely, we need the control mechanism. We need the policies. We need the law enforcement. We need to, you know, stop the supply, you know. We need to stop these traffickers from coming in and all that. But at the same time, there's a clinical approach to it, which is the mental health, the support from the hospital system, you know, because they could be addicted and we need to wean that out of their system. And then the last bit is the psychosocial intervention, which is the community involvement.
Actually, that's a great point. And I want to pose this to Amrin then, because underlying all that is also dealing with demand, right, as you said. Do you think, is that something that the government MHA is also looking at actively? And do you think will ever come the time where really the government can have a heart to heart and sit down and the youth can actually say, look, I've done this before. I put it on the table, I've done this before, and this is why I did it. I would like some help as to why I did it. Because as it stands now, it is so punitive that sometimes, obviously, people are not going to say, I've done drugs before, right? Because they know what the zero tolerance policy means for them. But is there a stage where we can actually speak to these young people, especially if they're young people, and say, look, you've done it, let us try to help you as well?
I think we have to be careful with that approach.
Okay.
Going too far down that line may actually send a message that it is okay to try one time and then you get a free pass. So we've got to be a bit careful mm-hmm. on that. But having said that, we have a different regime for young people.
Okay.
There is the NAMS clinic where they can seek help. It's at IMH. Mm-hmm. It's a support for addiction. That's one. And youths that are found guilty have a special regime. They can be channeled to a youth rehab centre mm-hmm. where it's step-down care where they're not put in the DRC, depending on, of course, the risk level. So I think that said, I would still urge caution in, you know, relaxing the regime because it is, the problem cannot be, you know, to solve one thing, you actually may lead to bigger problems if you do not get the fundamentals right.
I think that the point basically is not to relax the regime per se, but to understand more fully the demand. Why are people going there? And I suppose that's through data and through people who've actually already succumbed, and then you speak to them and you understand sociologically what led them towards the habit. I think that that's
The response to that is, in the last few years, we've really stepped up our preventive drug education. We used to have just a Just Say No campaign, mm-hmm. but we realized that actually youths would like to discuss. They may not take it, but they have seen it.
Exactly, yeah.
And so they would like to have a frank discussion.
Exactly, yes.
On this is what I've seen, this is what I've heard. Mm. You know, some people told me that it's actually not that harmful. What do you think? Mm-hmm. You know, so we have that open conversation. In schools, we go down to schools. We don't just tell them, "Oh, it's bad, and we'll throw you to jail."
Precisely.
Right? Yeah. It is not that kind of conversation. Mm-hmm. We have opened up. We have encouraged youth to discover for themselves. For instance, we ask them to do videos. We tell them, you know, go do your research. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, when you do the research, you will see, you will discover for yourself what are the harms of drugs. So we have engaged across all levels, the universities, polytechnics, ITEs, secondary schools. We even started primary school, actually, or preschool, you know.
Don't
we
scare
have
them.
not to scare them. We have different types of interventions or different types of approach for different kids at different levels of development. So for young people, we tell them through stories.
Yeah.
Right? For secondary school, we have a bit more discussion, you know, and we have cool people. We involve celebrities.
Yeah.
And as you know, we had Jackie Chan. Mm-hmm. We had Aaron Aziz to come on board, you know. And we have ordinary people, you know, photographers, videographers, you know, personalities to come on board and to actually send the message to counter this, you know, it's a game of winning the hearts and minds of people.
Okay.
I think that's key.
As I sort of close this off, I want to get both your views on a related issue, and that's of recidivism as well, because it's been raised now and then. So maybe Razwana as well. Do you see that as an issue in your research, in your conversations? And when you see that happening, whether or not it's related to MPSs, what does that point to you in terms of the necessary actions that need to be taken after that?
Okay, so the relapse prevention that we tried to do, or at least in the work that I used to do in the past, a lot of it got to do with the work that we can do with the community. So I agree, you know, completely that we need to have that zero tolerance approach. Mm-hmm. We need to detain some people. We need to keep them away from drugs so that they can get this detox, you know, out of their body and all that. But apart from that, when they are released into the community, we are doing changes. You know, we have made some changes to the law now. There is a lot more aftercare, you know, a lot of support given. But it's also about addressing the root cause. So you know, when we say that we need to address the desire, right, it is also about the structure within the community. Are they able to get a job? Are they, you know, classified as drug users, you know, drug abusers? The labeling that we put onto them, you see, the society that they are living in, you know, the family members that they are with. I give you an example. When my probationers used to go for urine tests, it was part of their order. Sometimes when they walk into the police station, they are sitting next to their aunt and their uncle and their cousins, you know, from different spectrum. So we have many different interventions for the young people, especially. We have guidance program that is, you know, completely no criminal records at all. You know, it's through the police station. We have CRCs, the community rehab centers. We have NAMS, of course, National Addiction Management Service, that provides support. You can go in to get help from them. You know, there's a substance, you know, doctors, you know, who handle this, you know, medication and, you know, and all that. So we have all that. But at the same time, the community, the family, that's the other aspect that we need to address. Yeah.
And Amrit?
I think certainly, I agree with what Razvana has said. There has to be a differentiated approach. First is you got to be firm to people who are thinking about it or people who have not done it. Please don't do it. Right. Please don't do it, because it's not a rosy path that you're going to walk. That part, so our preventive education, and in fact, our research have shown that many young people take notice when we tell them the laws are this. They actually, that is serves as a very strong deterrent. So that's one. But we must also have the compassion and support people who have taken drugs. We must let them know that there is a way out. And we must support, and we have done various things. We provided rehabilitation, support for work, employment. We have a career trial where we pay to get them have a form of a trial, an internship at the firms, and later on they get hired. And we have various schemes, you know, job matching, counselling, support for families. But I think it is something that we need to step up. And it's something that we need to do more, because it is quite overwhelming for the individual to have to bear the burden on his or her own. So I think there is a lot more that we can do together. The government realizes that, but the government cannot do it alone. And and this is also, I guess, a part where I sell a bit of koyo and send a message out to the community. If you're listening to this, you play a part, because you shape public opinion. You can help to support by coming on as a volunteer, supporting, encouraging. But of course, the best thing of all is prevention.
Amrin, Razvana, thank you so much. That's a great way to end, I suppose, maintaining the tough approach that we've always had, but including as far as possible a nice touch of compassion. Thank you so much for being here with me. This has been Heart of the Matter, which is available on the CNA website and app under the podcast tab. Or you can subscribe to us on Spotify or iTunes so you don't miss another episode. Till next week, I'm Jamie Ho. Behind me, my team, Lin Su Ling, Crispina Robert, and Aaron Lowe. Thank you.